I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of August. Our guest this hour, Andrew Rice, writes in the National Journal, "The notion that technology can open a portal into voters' minds is not a new idea. In 2012, Obama campaign staffers famously mined data to new extents of granular precision. What has changed is the sheer number of firms and consultants operating the political technology sector, huge sums of cash flowing into it, parties are fundraising for it, billionaire venture capitalists are investing in it, one eye on midterms and the other on 2016. Political technologists are constructing new weapons and experimenting with increasingly personalized targeting." Andrew Rice is our guest this hour. He's contributing editor at New York Magazine, has written for many publications, New York Times, also the Paris Review and other publications. His first book was "The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda." He lived in that country as a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs for several years. His areas of interest include, and what a list this is, dictatorship, democracy, New York real estate, African politics, intellectual property, international justice, immigration, Congress, witchcraft, urban planning, evangelical Christianity, baseball, and war. And the piece we talk about today is about how technology is being used to target voters. It is titled "Digital Tools Are Becoming More and More Central to the Process of Winning Your Vote. Just How Far Can Technology Reach?" We'll be welcoming phone calls for Andrew. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Hello, Andrew. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, fascinating article you've written. Let's start with that 2012 Obama campaign, because he evidently did something in that campaign that Republicans are trying to go one step beyond for midterms and, more importantly, for 2016. What did he do that built upon other campaigns but really hadn't been done before?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what he did, I think, the major thing that he did was he actually prioritized mining data in a way that that other campaigns hadn't done in the past. I mean, part of it is that each campaign, the history books of winning of campaigns are written by the winners, and so each campaign at the end of it comes out looking sort of like a bunch of geniuses, and the losing campaign looks like a bunch of idiots. But they were building on the some of the tactics that were originally developed, you know, by George Bush in 2004, refined by Obama during the long primary campaign in 2008. And then in 2012, what they did is, you know, because they had 4 years to sort of get ready for this reelection campaign, what they did is they built out this operation, and in Chicago it was called the nickname The Cave. It was like a room where a bunch of young kind of techies were sitting around, you know, looking at new ways to parse the electorate.
Mm-hmm. And the Romney campaign, on the other hand, they were way off with their internal polls. I guess they really thought they were going to win the election. Did they do that same kind of complete analysis of the electorate or not?
I mean, I think if I recall correctly, the numbers, I mean, I think that the Obama campaign had 50 people working on analytics, and the Romney campaign had a handful, you know, maybe certainly less than 10. And so they did not prioritize it in the same way. They used a sort of more traditional approach, which was based on polling, telephone polling, which the Obama campaign did a lot of too. Like, you know, the Romney campaign, again, I was sort of saying that some of this stuff gets retrospectively interpreted to make the winning candidate look great and the losing candidate look bad. The Romney campaign, you know, was doing, you know, similar stuff to what the Obama campaign was. They just weren't prioritizing it quite as much. And, you know, the upshot was is that they ended up having a very different point of view about what the electorate in 2012 was going to look like. They they made all kinds of miscalculations about the likely demographics of the turnout. They thought that there was going to be a lot less turnout from the core Democratic constituencies that supported Obama in 2008, and that led them to make some really off the wall, wrong projections.
When you look at the number of political technology companies that were involved in 2012 on both sides, and you write in the article about what has changed, it sounds like it's really changed. There has been a remarkable growth in the number of firms and the number of consultants. There's a whole lot of money in this area now. It has grown, hasn't it?
Well, first of all, the amount of money in politics in general has just exploded. So you know, when you're talking about campaigns that cost, you know, more than $1 billion, you know, for I think that in total, that, you know, it was on the order of, you know, tens of billions of dollars being spent on the entire 2012 election. You know, when you have that kind of money being spent on politics, there's a lot of market opportunity, and some smart people have recognized this and have been working on ways to try to capitalize and invest in the area, so that, you know, so invest in analytics, because they know that the campaigns have more money, they're capable of paying for these more sophisticated data crunching operations, and so you see a lot of money flowing into this area, and you see a lot of new startups, and some startup, you know, Eric Schmidt of Google, for instance, funded a startup that was founded by some of the former Obama people. There's another startup that's more nonpartisan that is funded by Mark Andreessen, the Netscape founder, and Pierre Omidyar, the eBay founder.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, lots of smart people are kind of putting money into this space to sort of see what can be, see if there's an opportunity not only to sort of advance political interests, but to make a little money.
Right. But you also warn that there are a lot of snake oil salesmen who are coming around trying to take advantage of all of this. I like this line: poke around the subject in your email inbox will soon begin to fill with subject lines that read like ads for male enhancement.
Well, yeah, that's true. The particular firm that inspired that, you know, was the one that claimed 5 extra points at the polls by using our software. I think it's not just politics that has this problem of exaggeration. I mean, this is like an area in which technology sort of startup ethic and advertising all sort of come together, and all of those areas are tend to be prone to making rather grand claims about new technological capabilities that may not necessarily be completely fulfilled in practice, let's put it that way.
Well, let's go inside one of these companies, and let's go inside one that you write is very difficult to get into, and that's I360, and you spent some time there. They say that they've got your number. If you're a living, breathing, voting-age American, the database you write contains, or they say it contains, more than 250 million individual profiles. What are they looking for? What is this company?
Well, so I360 is a company. It's a little bit of, you know, the reason it was a little difficult to get in to talk with them is because they're funded via they're part of this sort of nonprofit network of companies funded by affiliated with the Koch brothers. So they're definitely on the Republican side of the spectrum. What they do isn't all that much more all that different or more intrusive than what the Democrats do or what any of these companies do, which is basically they take any little piece of information that they can find about you and try to put it into a profile so that they can plot where you are on the ideological spectrum. And the reason why is because they think, there's a good, you know, sociological research to suggest it, that this is true, is that, you know, it's much easier to to try to appeal to and motivate a person who's already kind of convinced that they agree with you to go and vote than it is to change someone's mind.
Mm-hmm.
So what these companies are really trying to do is help candidates to figure out who are the people who want to vote for you, who are the people who are inclined to be motivated to hear your message and go to the polls, and how can we best reach them. And, you know, that reaching can be done by a knock on the door. That reaching can be done by a very targeted ad. If you open up your web browser, click on YouTube, you see these little pre-roll videos and you think, oh, how did that get there?
Like, right.
That happens. That pre-roll video happens to be related to, you know, I was the other day, I was looking at this movie website, and what do you know? I see a preview for that same movie on my web browser.
I know.
Well, so politicians can do this too. If they think that if somebody thinks that you are, you know, think that you are a supporter of a conservative, free market, libertarian, low tax type, if you're a supporter of that philosophy, they can show you an ad that says, "Hey, you know, here is a candidate who agrees with you on all these points of view." Show you the ad, and you know, the hope is that'll kind of become a little tiny piece of motivation that will help to make you aware of the election and help you, you know, sort of prod you on your way to the voting booth
mm-hmm.
in November.
Andrew, let's talk a little bit about television, because you write about the huge amount of money that's going into television advertising. And something I was not aware of, that by the presidential race in 2016, because of digital TV, if I'm watching a show that's the same show that my neighbor is watching, the ad that I'm seeing, the political ad, may be different than the political ad my neighbor is seeing. That's amazing to target like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a developing. The people who work in this area say this is just a little over the horizon, but the technology is there. Certain companies are doing this kind of stuff. For instance, the Dish Network has what is called addressable TV, and addressable just basically means that you buy specific kind of. Instead of buying saying, I want to advertise during Two and a Half Men on, you know, in the Minneapolis area, what you say is, I want to buy a sort of basket of people who all fit a certain demographic that you happen to know. As the Dish Network, because you know that they actually all have profiles on you too, so you know, like the politicians kind of input their profile of, you know, all the they put input say a million people that they want to reach, and then the ad seller has a list of, you know, of people that are subscribers. And then where they get matches, say they get 500,000 matches, then you do 500,000 impressions of this ad to these people at times when they're watching their television.
Mm-hmm. You also point to the Obama and Romney campaigns, and again, Obama figured some of this out and did targeted advertising, whereas the Romney campaign went the more traditional route. Is that fair to say? And did a lot of advertising on news programs.
Yes, I mean I think that the number was that, you know, Romney outspent the Obama campaign 8-1 buying news programs, and the Obama campaign, and you know, I'm not the first person to have written about this. It was quite well publicized, but one of the sort of innovative things that they did was that they sort of took they figured out that they they had these profiles of people, you know, that they had developed in the cave, and they could cross-reference them against data taken from set-top boxes. There's a company called RentTrack that does this work.
Really?
And basically it tracks, you know, you've got this little set-top box sitting on your TV. You know, it's tracking everything that you're watching. It knows when you've got your television on. It knows when you're fast-forwarding through things. It knows everything you're DVRing.
Oh, my goodness.
So the Obama campaign could use this data to sort of say, okay, we want to reach this group of, say, you know, they would say, we want to reach a group of, I'm just making this up, Asian American women who are liberal on women's issues, who happen to live in swing states, and then so the, you know, they happen to have the names of those people that they wanted and their profiles, they could give them to RenTrak, and RenTrak, it would be anonymized, like so RenTrak wouldn't tell the Obama campaign we advertised a Jane Doe at such and such address, but they would say, okay, of the list of people that you gave us, we were able to match up with X number of people. You know, here's the body of overlap, and then here are the things that they're watching. And the Obama campaign discovered all sorts of interesting stuff. Like, for instance, they've discovered that the same person, a lot of the people that they wanted to reach could be reached more cost effectively by, say, advertising on, a television program at 1 a.m, you know, or a cable show, sort of an obscure rerun on the Cartoon Network or something like that, mm-hmm. would reach younger male people that they wanted to appeal to. So, you know, they could figure out a way to make their ad budget go farther. Now that's like a crude method of doing what we were talking about earlier. Like, the more advanced method of doing it is not just sort of figuring out what the people in your demographic are watching and then buying ads on those programs, but rather buying those people's attention by actually just beaming commercials directly to their set-top box when they're watching whatever it is that they're watching. Mm.
I guess we've pretty much given up, unless we just don't know that this is happening, any kind of outrage that people know all of this about us. I mean, in a way, it's a little frightening, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on how you feel about being targeted for advertising. Because, I mean, I think, most of us have had the experience of, you know, you're looking for a pair of shoes online. And then,
sure, right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you just see those shoes everywhere you go online. And, well, you know why that is. There's like a little cookie that's put on your browser, and it's just it kind of sits there on your browser, and it informs, you know, these automated ad networks that you're interested in buying a pair of shoes. So they keep hitting you with shoe ads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to personally, for me, I'm not terribly outraged by that. I kind of feel like it's robots and, you know, that are looking at it and not really any human intelligence that particularly cares what shoes I'm looking for. But it does get more complex when you get into the realm of political beliefs, because,
right,
you know, if people in theory, a candidate could do something like, you know, look at what kind of websites you're going to, you know, if you're going to websites to find out information about guns, for instance, or something, they could make a presumption on about your political beliefs based on that, and then try to buy tailored advertisements that just reach you directly, that say, you know, either, you know, say we're in favor of the Second Amendment and so on, and you know, that does get a little bit more, I feel like, you know, for most people, that starts to feel a little bit more creepy, because they're not looking at consumer behavior, and they're looking at sort of a philosophical position that you have, and it does start to get, and the more it gets personalized, the more it starts to feel a little bit invasive and a little bit like they are sort of advertising directly to you. So I can understand why people get angry. The one other thing I'll add is that, you know, when you say, have we lost our sense of outrage, in some ways I feel like people don't completely know. They have a general sense that there is some monitoring that goes on. But then every once in a while something happens. Like, for instance, when it was revealed that Facebook was doing these experiments where where they were showing happy news to one group of people in their yeah. in their news feed, and sad news to one, another group of people in their news feed, and then seeing if those people's, you know, Facebook updates reflected happiness or sadness.
Right.
And, you know, that came out, and that, listen, I write about this stuff a lot, and I can tell you that this is not at all an anomalous sort of thing for Facebook to be doing. Web companies, especially social networks, are constantly experimenting on you in ways that you don't realize, and typically because they want to be able to more efficiently sell you goods, and their valuation is all based on, they give you this free service, and the thing that they're selling is your eyeball to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, so it didn't sound surprising to me that Facebook was doing this, but, you know, when people found this out, it went viral, you know, and all of a sudden people said, oh, this is terrible. Like, Facebook is really, you know, treating us like guinea pigs. And so I guess maybe the thing is that people don't really completely know all the stuff that advertisers are doing, both on the consumer level and on the political level.
Andrew Rice is our guest this hour, and he wrote a very interesting piece in the National Journal, and it's about how technology is being used to target voters. Midterms are just around the corner, and for that matter, so is the 2016 presidential race. And in addition to describing the enormous amounts of money and all the companies that are involved in data mining, he looks at a couple of those companies and what it is they're doing. But, in the piece, he also asks, what about those who are undecided? We keep hearing that elections are determined based on people who are undecided and, of course, based on who gets to the polls. So do all of these techniques help move people to the polls? Can they at all sway people who have not decided who they're going to vote for? It's really big business, and man, oh man, are they ever getting information on all of us. What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We spoke briefly about, I think, direct mail. I get a whole bunch of direct mail. I don't know if you do as well, but how effective is direct mail? Andrew writes about that in the piece. He writes about personal interactions. He writes about following what people are saying online so they can enlist core supporters to recruit their friends. We can talk more about television. And the whole new field, although it's just growing. It started some years ago. He mentions President George W. Bush's campaign and some of the data being used for that campaign, and now it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. To you in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Andrew. 800-486-8655 is our number. We start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl. Carl, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
I apologize, I didn't hear you. I don't know what it is about your program, Kathleen, but I find myself pulling over on the side of the road because the conversation is just very engaging.
Thanks, Carl.
One of my favorite authors, Marilynne Robinson, was writing about Abraham Lincoln and talking about him speaking in a farm field, Galesburg, Illinois, during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and not dumbing down his words and speaking for hours on end about complex topics with the faith that those farmers in the field would be able to understand and internalize what he was saying because he himself had been a farmer in a similar field.
Mm.
And I feel that we've come so far from Lincoln, who spoke from what was in his heart, what was in his mind about what a good democracy looks like, and then put it out there to the surrounding community to see whether it would resonate. And we've moved instead to just sort of, well, what's resonating in bits and bytes on the surfaces of our online composite personalities, and whatever you'd find in those bits and bytes, I doubt that better angels of our nature would be among them. And it seems to me that we're fast becoming, not the electorate deserving of the kind of politician that in our heart of hearts we wish we'd see leading us.
Mm.
And I'm just interested in the guest perspective on the surface nature and the cloying pandering to those surface aspects of ourselves instead of the deeper and more engaging conversation that might ensue if we, if our politicians truly spoke from their heart.
What deeply interesting comments, Carl. Andrew.
Well, I mean, I guess my answer to be to that would be yes, but I mean, I guess the yes part would be, you know, one thing that became evident to me in the research as I did reporting on this was that the discourse, especially over technology and politics, is all about sort of how you would target these sort of microscopic sort of constituencies within the electorate, and sort of. Yeah, of course, all the consultants would always say, well, the candidate needs to have a good, consistent message. But, you know, what they, you know, the sort of really what they're selling is the ability to kind of shade your political identity as a candidate in different ways to appeal to different constituencies of people and to kind of like try to dice the electorate into such little teeny tiny parts that that this like broad overarching message is perhaps not nearly as prioritized. All that said, I would on the caller's point about Lincoln, you know, and going out in the fields, you know, obviously, you know, I'm not going to disparage Abraham Lincoln, but you know,
no,
you know,
of course not.
if you read the history of politics in the 19th century. First of all, it was extraordinarily there was actually during Lincoln's time in presidency, there was a pretty vicious civil war that that broke out, which was not at all what I would consider to be an idyllic sort of form of political discourse. Second of all, you know, the idea of, you know, a candidate in those times, and you read this in the sort of contemporary accounts of politics, yes, the candidate in those days would go out and he'd stand in a field and he'd give a speech for, you know, they would speak in those days because it was considered like entertainment. They'd speak for 5 hours about, you know, about these airy generalities. But oftentimes the presidential candidate would then get on a train, go to like another place and give a different speech, which would say that they believe something categorically opposite to what they told those people, you know, in the other town. Like before the monitoring, before this, like we all say, monitoring is, you know, terrible. But one thing that it is able to do is kind of make sure that candidates aren't saying one thing to one group of people, constituency, and one thing to another. Or at least if they are saying it, they there's a built-in check that, you know, that the press and journalists and so on can sort of say, hey, you know, this person's being a flip-flopper, or this person's trying to be all things to all people. And I think, you know, without editorializing too much, I think the Romney campaign figured out that that's not a particularly attractive attribute in a candidate, a perception of being kind of willing to say anything to any given audience, you know, when he thinks the camera's turned off, if that's what it takes to get their votes or their donations.
To get more to Carl's point, though, of being able to address a crowd of people who are not extremely well educated, but who care about what's going on. You write in your piece that politicians really still have this old-fashioned problem, which Abraham Lincoln had, and he knew how to do this, that it's not enough to get inside voters' heads, which all of this technology allows us to do. We're inside a lot of people's heads, but you have to have something to say once you're there. So how does all of this, you know, bits and pieces, not only it gets to somebody's head, but what's it saying to them once they're there? How do you get that message so that there's some substance to all of this?
Well, I mean, that's the unquantifiable thing about politics, right? I mean, certain candidates sort of have an ability at certain junctures in time to sort of capture this aspirational desire that some people have. You know, I think most people, most voters, kind of want to vote for somebody who seems like they're calling the country to a higher purpose. I mean, you know, I think Obama in 2008 certainly captured that for a lot of people. I do think that sort of impetus within, you know, within our electoral system, though, is counteracted by, you know, a lot of forces that are driving us to division. And one of the forces that I think is driving us to division is this instinct that within the political system to try to win elections by piecing together the sort of narrow coalitions of core supporters.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carl, so much for your call. John in Janesville is next. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
All right, John. How are you?
Not too bad. I just called because I was thinking the same thing. If you go to a site, all of a sudden they got you down and they start bombarding you with stuff. It doesn't make me want to buy their stuff. It makes me pissed off and I won't ever buy their stuff. And I think it's the same with politics. When they start bombarding you, it just pisses you off on people. Where you're getting 5 and 6 mails a day from candidates, and I just, the ones that come in the mail, actually, I just throw in the trash. I don't even look at them.
Mm. To say nothing.
And I'm like, how much money are they spending?
I know. Isn't that the truth? To say nothing of the television ads, and when it gets close to the election, they're repeating the same ad, you know, every other minute, and it just drives you crazy. You just have money to burn, it seems to me. He makes an interesting point. Has anybody done an analysis, as they're targeting all this, all of us in our various categories, how much of this is effective, or how many of these pieces just go into the trash, or in terms of television ads, we just, you know, tape everything we're watching and zip right through them?
Well, this isn't just a problem of political advertising. This is a problem of advertising. I mean, John Wanamaker, the department store entrepreneur in the 19th century, you know, famously said, "I believe that half of my advertising money is wasted. The problem is I don't know which half." It's been historically very, very difficult to kind of get any kind of metrics on the effectiveness of advertising. And therefore, most candidates, like most brands, move from sort of basically went on gut instinct or fear of doing doing the thing that would, you know, be the least likely to be second guessed. So, for instance, buying television advertising on network news programs like Mitt Romney did. You know, that's nobody's going to get fired for buying the network news, right? On the other hand, you know, the fact of the matter is that with web advertising is a little different. That, you know, what it does promise is an ability to track in ways that are far more sophisticated how effective advertising is. And some of the statistics are really sobering. You know, the statistic within the industry is, I think, you know, less than 0.1% of all ads on web pages are clicked on.
Oh my goodness!
And you know that is a really sobering number.
Right.
You know, the web ad people will say, well, you know, if you do millions and millions and millions of ads, that's still kind of a significant effect. And then they also say, well, what we also don't know is how effective is television advertising. We don't have any metric to know how many people see a Chevy commercial and say, "Hey, I think I'm going to buy a Chevy truck." I mean, my feeling about it is that, you know, in most cases, probably that sort of brand advertising, you know, results in very few direct sales. You know, it's quite unusual, I think, that advertising, that you can draw a direct line between an advertisement and some kind of consumer effect. So, mm-hmm. the answer to your person's question is he may get angry about it, about being bombarded with all those ads. But you know, there might be somebody down the street who turns into a voter as a result of it, and the campaign's calculation is that person's, you know, the motivating that one person is worth maybe turning off the other person.
Andrew Rice, our guest this hour. We're talking about political technology and how it was used by Obama successfully in the 2012 campaign, Romney not as successfully. What were the techniques that were used that were cutting edge? And what's happened since then? You can rest assured that seeing the success of Obama's campaign, the Republicans have been actively working to replicate and go beyond the success of that campaign. And Andrew writes about in detail some of these companies and what it is they're doing to find out what the electorate is thinking about various things. And they're really pinpointing a lot of not only what our buying patterns are and how old we are and whether or not we live in a conservative or a liberal area, but also what our thoughts may be in terms of abortion, in terms of guns, in terms of various issues, depending on what we've purchased, which is a little frightening to some. Andrew is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. He's written for a number of publications. This particular piece appears in the National Journal, and we're welcoming phone calls. We have some lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're also on Facebook at the Kathleen Dunn Show and on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. Andrew, here's a Facebook message from Becca who says, I don't know anyone who pays any attention to election ads. To me and most people, I know they're just a lot of BS. And the robocalls, they will make me not vote for you. How about just a statement of who you are and your beliefs and what you'll do in office? Leave it at that. Stop the bashing. Stop the robocalls. Stop the ads.
Well, I mean, you know, it's difficult. If candidates thought that was an effective way to win election, they would do it. You know, it's obviously you can't win election by opting out of the system and not articulating your message to the electorate. You know, she may feel that way about political advertisements, but then, you know, if you have a system that's built around the discourse being largely conducted on television and largely conducted in an adversarial way because that's the way our system works. I mean, I guess ultimately that's a decision on the part of the voter to opt out of participating in the electoral system altogether.
Mm-hmm. She mentioned the robocalls. You write in your article about the what you call increasingly glaring failings of traditional telephone calls. There are a number of households only using cell phones now, and there are poll response rates that are really not very good on landlines. Fallen, you write, from about 40% to less than 10% in the 1990s. Does that mean we're not going to get them anymore?
Well, I mean, you know, you talk to the, I mean, obviously pollsters think that they're still able to accurately reflect the electorate through statistical modeling based on the responses that they do receive. But you know, you talk to the experts, and they say there is a breaking point at which, you know, that breaking point is, you know, at some point the people who are answering landline phones become so unrepresentative of the demographics of the population as a whole that it's very difficult to get a statistically solid sample from them. So. You know, as response rates fall, we're getting closer and closer to that point. It's hard to know where it lies. But there are a lot of pollsters who are trying innovative things that don't just rely on calling landlines. But it becomes a little difficult because there are lots of rules about how you reach people on their cell phones, and they're governed by a different set of laws.
Ty in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I find it kind of interesting that, you know, we're talking about how a couple comments kind of kind of grab onto the big business of advertising and data mining. I call it personal data mining. For manufacturing or distribution, I can see it being advantageous. But if it wasn't really advantageous for politicians to use it in order to polarize that certain constituency group to vote a certain way, as you call it, energize that base, it wouldn't really be as big business as it is. What was the total spend on these type of advertisements in the last presidential election? What, $1 billion, $1.2 billion? And you don't necessarily get a true representation of the politician when they're advertising like this, because it is such a small sliver of information they're trying to deliver to get that group to vote for them.
Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is certainly well taken. It's difficult to, I mean, all advertisements are in some way or another, even a 30-second television spot or a web advertisement or a YouTube pre-roll video. I mean, all these things are going to ultimately be advertising, which means that they're a form of propaganda, which means that they're not necessarily going to be fully representative of the candidate, warts and all. At some point it becomes incumbent on the voters themselves to seek out other types of information if they want to make their decision based on something more than advertisements. It's unlikely that we're going to ban advertising, political advertising, or curtail it. I mean, the Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that that political spending is the same thing as political speech, and mm-hmm. therefore can't be curtailed under the First Amendment. So, these advertisements are not going to go away as a practical matter. But it's if voters really feel strongly that they want to educate themselves about candidates, there's lots of ways to do it. There are typically debates. You can read a newspaper. You can go seek out all sorts of information deeply. There's a wealth of information on any given candidate online. I think what you'll find, though, is that the majority of voters probably, unlike the self-selecting group of callers to this program, are not all that eager to go and do the sort of like extra sort of research that is required to come up with a truly holistic, informed opinion about any given politician. They're often making decisions based on kind of snap judgments.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ty, for your call. Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi.
Well, I think I'm going to kind of follow up on that.
All right.
I think that we can't blame politicians and corporations that own them and whoever their minions are who are out there for saying the things they do, for using the advertising, for using the sound bites, for all of that, when we refuse to use our muscle in our brain to, first of all, say, who's telling me this? Why are they telling me this? And what do they want from me? And we just, take it in. And so, it's injected into our veins, and it's, And it shouldn't be. And so until we decide as a group that we're going to ask questions, and I know it takes time, but you can still ask the question just of yourself. You can still, very easily pull up that link. We can say, who's behind this ad? Who's behind the talker, the speaker who's saying whatever it is?
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't. We're lazy because thinking does not require space and time, and it doesn't require a lot of money, and we just refuse to think. And so we get what we, it's sort of like switching from a newspaper to USA Today or People Magazine. We chose to do that.
Andrew, thank you very much for your comments, Ellen. Worthwhile. Andrew?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. I don't have that much to add. I think that politicians, we would like for politicians to speak to us like adults. And I think that they would do it if if there was more evidence that speaking to us like adults was an effective way to get us to vote for them. But the sad fact of the matter is that, you know, oftentimes the things that people in the electorate respond to tend to be these sort of lowest common denominator arguments. And that's true on the liberal side and the conservative side. It's not a party issue. It's not one party is dumber than the other. I think both parties, in a way, have kind of figured out that there are sort of weak spots and hot button issues that voters will respond to, and they very skillfully manipulate those that knowledge in order to kind of turn out their partisans and to get people really excited.
So I assume that with all the money and all the firms involved in this, that they have done research showing that the data mining has been effective in getting those who would probably vote for you anyhow to get to the polls to vote for you. You also, in the article, though, asked the question, what about persuading the undecided? And say, despite a century worth of psychological study, persuasion remains something of a mystery, even to the experts.
Right. Well, I mean, if people knew what it took to persuade the electorate to vote for them, then that would truly be the a killer piece of technology. But I mean, perhaps mercifully, that knowledge still remains beyond the scope of our technological abilities. You know, the fact of the matter is that what motivates somebody to change their mind or to think about something differently is just still such a terribly unquantifiable thing, and we don't really quite know. You know, I think we know more about how voters tend to behave, but I think that the more that we know, you know, the thing is, the technology gives us a way to track people in a way that they never have been before.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You know, we know where, when I say we, I mean, you know, the people who have these repositories of information know sort of who you're friends with. They know who you call on a regular basis. If you have a GPS in your phone, they can know where you are at any given time. They can know what your daily routine is. They can know, you know, what you're shopping for. They can know, you know, what your political opinions that you express to your friends on Facebook are, and so on and so forth. They know all of these things about you, but on some level, the crucial thing of sort of plumbing how it is that most people end up making decisions is still beyond the reach of technology.
Right. Let's take a quick, she's gone at this point. And finally, and if you can say in about 30 seconds, have there been studies done of what seems to be most effective still? Is it the television ad? Is it direct marketing? Is it something completely different? What is it?
I mean, I think every candidate, you know, does a little bit of all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And they mix it up in different ways. And afterwards, it's that thing I said before. It's, you know, the winning candidate looks like a genius and the losing candidate looks
right.
like a dunce.
Right.
You know, and was it the tactics or was it the message? Was it Obama's tactics that won the election, or was it the fact that, you know, he had a more persuasive economic
yeah.
message than Mitt Romney? I don't know. Nobody
yeah.
knows.
Andrew, thank you so much. It's really an interesting piece. It's in the National Journal. Andrew Rice is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. He writes for a number of publications. The piece is about how technology is being used to target voters. It's really becoming a very large business, growing over the last, I don't know, 8 years or so, but significantly so since the last presidential election. So we thank him for his time. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in sunny downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return for another hour of our program looking at the Kandinsky exhibit at the Museum in Milwaukee.